Accession number 28640, Reel 2.
Andy Dent, Reel 2. So you've just been transferred to 138 Squadron at Thamesford. Had you been given any information about the squadron prior to going there?
No, none whatsoever. In fact, I had never seen a Halifax before, and this was the aircraft I was told I was going to look after. Similarly, the chief, the flight sergeant in charge of maintenance there, he had never seen Halifax before. So it took quite a few days of circuit, what they call circuits and bumps, which is we'd have two or three pilots on board who would be given the opportunity to fly this aircraft and to land it and to take it off, and consequently myself and the flight sergeant, we got to know about the aircraft from our particular direction. Then I didn't go on briefings, but I was told that our job on 138 Squadron was to take Joes. That was the name that was given to agents, because if anybody went down, this is a similar sort of conversation I have on that tape that I made. Joes were a name given to agents so that if anybody was in their cups and they talked about taking Joes somewhere, it could mean anything. But that was the name that was given to agents, and we took them all over the place. It was on the 13th op that we were shot down, but prior to that I'd done two trips to Poland. I was kept pretty busy because I was flying with we were short of aircraft. I was the only flight engineer there, and I was flying with Polish, Australian, English, and English crews, so that...
What did you find the best?
Oh, the Poles were had been flying well before the English had entered the war. They were professionals. Commissioned. And
did you find them easy to get on with?
So there wasn't a great deal of communication between us. I think the only time that I ever spoke to the Polish skipper was to say, when we were shot down, we had two starboard engines were on fire. My job was to try and put the flames out, but the extinguishing apparatus didn't operate, probably shot up. So my first words to the captain were, "Sorry, skipper, I'm unable to put out the fires in the two engines." That was it. And within a space of less than a minute, we were down on the deck.
Before you carry on with that story, which is absolutely fascinating, can you just tell me some details about your prior missions? You said you went to Poland. Was that the sort of furthest extent of the plane?
Well, we went two trips to Poland, and the aircraft was virtually a frying petrol tank. The whole of the fuselage was taken up with two huge tanks containing petrol. I believe we were carrying bullion, which is the universal paymaster that would be given to anybody who wanted to do undercover work in anywhere. And it was, as I say, a universal coinage. Prior to our flights, there had been one flight to Poland, because they were non-stop. And
how did you go? Did you go over Germany or skirt around?
We used to fly because we wanted to see a town lit up. We used to fly over Denmark. And of course there was a lovely lion shooting a lovely lion there. I had to keep a log of height, speed, direction and all that sort of business, petrol consumption. And flying across Denmark, you would be flying below sea level. And at our height, which was somewhere about 300 feet, the altimeter would be reading naught. So that was a lovely line shoot that we were flying at naught feet. crossing the Skagerrak, we were head for Malmo, which was in neutral Sweden, and just fly 4 or 5 miles out. And Malmo would be lit up. So it was one of our reading points, because we only flew by map reading. There was no map reading, and a compass were our only two
aids, I suppose.
Aids, yes. That's right.
Were you below radar then?
There was no radar as such which could reach that distance in any case. And there was, you had to be up to about 20,000, 30,000 feet before you got any, even a radio contact back home. We didn't carry a wireless, obviously. There was just two pilots, a pilot, co-pilot, myself, and another air crewman, usually a air gunner, who was called a dispatcher. You've read about that. He looked after the agents on the aircraft, and when we got to the dropping zone, he dispatched them. We had on the lower part of the fuselage, there was a hole somewhere in the region of 6 to 7 feet in diameter, which was closed by two doors during flight, but the doors were opened up for the agents to sit on the edge of this hole, and their chutes would be attached to static lines. And when we reached the dropping area, they would just jump out, and the static lines would open up their parachutes after they'd cleared the tailplane.
What sort of height did they jump from?
A couple of hundred feet, 300 feet, something like that.
Quite low, really.
Well, you had to fly at that. Yeah. We only...
Did you have to pick up signals from the ground?
Oh, yes. We were given... Or they were given these... there'd be a circle or a triangle, and a single letter would be beamed out on our approach, and we would reply with our letter. I can't remember the name of the machine, electric light.
Sort of like a strobe lighty thing, was it?
Used mainly on ships at sea for
signaling.
Oh, signaling.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. And, we only flew during close to full moon, because that was our only light that we had to map read. There was no other way we could get to these places other than by map reading.
How long did it take you to get to Poland?
I think we were flying somewhere in the region of... 15 and 17 hours. It would be entirely dependent on the wind direction.
So, flying by the light of the moon, you would make yourself a bit vulnerable for flak?
Oh, yes. I mean, we were within cannon range, and that's what happened when we crossed the coast of France.
So you went to Poland a couple of times?
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say that a previous flight to Poland, they'd run out of petrol. Now, this is one of the problems. You don't know what sort of headwind or wind you're going to meet. And if you aren't careful, if the flight engineer doesn't keep a constant check on petrol consumption and in relation to the speed of the engines and the wind, if we knew what was happening, this first flight that went to Poland had to ditch in the North Sea. And on the two occasions that we went to Poland...
Were they picked up?
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah.
And on your two occasions, did you get back all right?
Petrol gauge reading virtually naught.
Quite nail-biting, then.
Well, we knew what we were doing, so that we either headed for Tangmere again, which had emergency landing procedure there.
Where is Tangmere?
In Sussex, virtually on the coast. And the other place we landed was Odiham in Hampshire. Can I just catch myself?
So what size squadron was it?
Well, there were two squadrons on the so-called... at Thamesford. I was in 138 squadron, and as far as I know, at that particular time, there was just the one Halifax. Now, the other squadron, 166, had Lizzie's, Lysanders, and they were very high-winged. I don't really know what a Lysander looks like, but very high-winged aircraft, and they could take off and land in very short distance. So they were used to fly in agents and land them in France and Belgium. We then took on 138 squadron, then took on the longer flights. As I've just said, Poland. We were mostly southern France. Denmark, and Poland, that was the flights I was associated with. On the night that we were shot down, we were heading for the Le Massif Central, which is a large plateau, mountainous area towards southeastern France. But there was very high Mackie activity in that particular area, and we were taking not only agents there, but I believe there was some supplies on board. I couldn't always see what was in the.
Were the agents always men?
No, on this particular occasion it was a man and his wife, we understood, and their age would have been, I think I described it as about the same age as my mother and father, in their 40s.
Do you think they were French people living in England or English people that had trained?
I have no idea. No.
Within the actual squadron and where you were based, was the security very high?
Oh, yes, total.
Were you allowed off the base?
We had transport to take us into Sandy. The sergeants, there was the officers, and they stuck together. They had their own mess. We didn't have any bar or what have you. So we used to go once a week into Sandy pub in there, and they that was our night out.
Was there a high casualty rate amongst the squadron?
From what I understood, I haven't read through that book up there because my reading is so limited. But hopefully, I'll get somebody who can give me a hand in just checking up. But from what I understand, there was a pretty high casualty rate, which was not unexpected at the height we were flying.
Is that why there was only one flight engineer on the squadron?
I should imagine there had been a shortage, and that's why I got posted there.
So it was your 13th mission when you went off to the Massif Central?
Yes. Yeah.
So talk me through that.
Well, we took off as norm with two agents, and just as we were crossing the coast of France near Caen, we came under cannon fire, and two engines were shot up straight away, and as I explained earlier on, I couldn't put the flames out. So this Polish pilot brought us down in a fantastically great landing with belly flop. Don't put the wheels up because the field was too small. And that was the best way of taking a short landing distance. My position on the aircraft was immediately under a astrodome, which is an area where normally one would take star and moon sights. But this is my place where I could observe features which were asked of me to find when we were map reading. I had my own map, but with no course marked on it. But I was asked to look out for small towns, railway lines, rivers, anything which would show up in moonlight.
Was it cold standing up in there?
No, there was plenty of heat. Well, we were only at 300-400 feet, and I think on this particular flight it was April, wasn't it? Because I didn't get back until April, May. Didn't get back to England until June.
So this was April 43?
Yeah. I think you'll find in my records there's I've underlined it, the date posted as missing.
Oh yes, 13th of April 1943.
And then there's a date further on which says return to England.
Flew back from Gibraltar 1st, 2nd of June.
Yeah. So we were...
So you managed to land?
Oh, we managed to land. I got the Astrodome off, pushed our two... agents out through that astrodome hole, and then got the pilots through, and then the dispatcher got him through so that he'd have a final word with the agents. I understood them to be French. I'll get you we all got out, and we all took off. I and the crew, four of us, the two agents went off. We weren't going to tell them where to go, and the four of us, I suggested we headed south. In those days, we were given a handkerchief on which was printed a map of France, and one of our buttons was in fact a compass. So I said,
did you get any field craft training as well for evading capture?
No, I was a country bumpkin.
So that held you in good stead then.
So I just said to myself, if we head cross country, I'm not afraid of cows. We can knock up throw stones up at farmhouse windows, which is what we did.
Did you attract the Germans? I mean, were they aware that they'd
the Germans
taken you down?
Yeah, but also at the same time, the Mackie and the undercover people and the they would know that we'd been shot down, and the message would be got back to England fairly sharpish. So that from then on, once communications had been set up between the undercover people and England, the undercover people would be told what to do with us. And I think that is what happened. We were eventually we were hiding up one more early morning underneath a hedge, and the farm worker came along and he said, "English? Yes. Wait here." And he came back with clothing and identity cards. So from then on, we were pointed in a particular direction and to wait for somebody to pick us up.
Did you travel at night or?
Oh, quite a lot of time during the night, particularly early morning or late evening would be the best time for travelling.
It'd be quite light that time of year, early and late.
And and Jerry wouldn't be particularly awake early in the morning.
Were they looking for you?
Well, I'm sure they were, because if you read the script in that 138 Squadron booklet there, the two agents were picked up, brutally treated, and only one survived. We split up, the two pilots went their way, and the dispatcher himself went another way.
And was that on your instigation or the Marquis?
I think the Poles wanted, they were officers, they wanted to do their own thing. They had exactly the same navigational aids as we had. Perhaps they had a bit better, larger. Anyway, we had enough, and all we had to do was aim south. France at that particular time was divided into three areas. The whole of the outside area with the coast, up against the coast and against Switzerland, Belgium, etc., was known as Zone Interdit, the forbidden zone. The next zone inside, towards the centre of France, was known as Zone Occupé. And then there was a central zone where Pétain had his government, and it was called Zone Inoccupé. And we got into the Zone Inoccupé and were taken.
How did you cross the Loire?
Well, what we did do was avoid roads. Anywhere near where we thought we might be picked up, we just kept the countryside. And we stayed with a family for 3 days whilst we sort of recovered.
And they were taking quite a risk then, weren't they?
Oh, obviously, yeah. Although there was less of a risk in that particular area because it was known as the Zone Inoccupé. I mean, if you think in terms of Germans occupying all these places, they had a tremendous number of people who were just doing nothing except keeping their eyes open. They were all over the place.
Did you speak French?
Schoolboy French. enough to fire some stones up to a farmhouse window and at night time and say, "Je suis aviateur en caille, voulez-vous me donner du pain, s'il vous plaît?" And that's how we got on.
And were people fairly receptive, or were they suspicious that you were a German agent, seeing whether they were susceptible?
We didn't expect anything, but normally, or on three occasions that I did fire stones at it, they set dogs on us. Mm. So we can't blame them.
No.
But we went round to their hen houses and helped ourselves to eggs.
So what did you survive on?
Eggs and...
raw? Or did you manage to make a fire? Or?
Oh, no, no. There was, that would attract too much attention. Now, we were given some bread. About a week after we'd been on the road, or off the road, shall I say. So that was enough to keep us chuntering along until we got to zone Unokibe.
You must have been looking a bit ragged by this time,
well,
shaving-wise.
We were in pretty ragged clothing. We'd discarded our uniforms.
Did that worry you? Because would you have been regarded as not as prisoner of war without your uniform?
No, it was... Escape was the rule. I mean, for instance, we had to discard our flying boots because they were fleece-lined, and we had to cross a small river whilst we were going across country, and our boots got absolutely soaking wet and our feet started to go bad. Mm. And
so how did you cope then?
Well, having met up with this chap who asked if we were English and supplied us with clothing, he in turn, we told him about his boots and our poor feet, and he turned up with gum boots, which had been cut off here, so that we had virtually galoshes. Mine were so large that I had to stuff them with hay to wear them. So that problem was solved. So we had clothing and identity cards at that time. And then...
And you lived off bread and raw eggs?
Yes, well, apart from that two or three days in the zone occupé, where we stayed with the family. I stayed with one family, and the dispatcher he stayed with, I still don't even know his name. He stayed with another family. So we got physically fitted up again. We only had a couple of adventures with Jerry, and one was we were sleeping, we'd slept under a hedge one night in a field which had a little sign on it that said Camp de Tir, C-A-M-P de T-I-R. Well, my French was limited, so I didn't know what that meant. We went in there and slept. In the morning we were more or less wakened by a couple of Jerry sentries with armed with rifles and bayonets. I was able to interpret all I said was we know to whatever the Germans asked us, and carte d'identité, yes, and I showed that to my colleague and he got out his. We got up and
they seemed convinced then.
Oh yes, they said Rouse. So we went off.
They thought you were a couple of sort of trampy types.
Tramps, yeah. learned later that Camp de Tir was a German artillery camp. There's nothing like being one of the innocents. And the other problem we had was trying to cross the Loire, which is, you know, the longest and biggest river in France. Fortunately, it was tidal, so we couldn't cross the bridge, any of the bridges that were, because the bridges were guarded by Germans. It's on that tape. So we waited until night, until nighttime, and the tide had gone out, and then we waded across.
Whereabouts were you then to be in the tidal regions of the Loire?
Oh, the river was what? about 3/4 of a mile wide, I suppose.
So it's quite near the estuary out near Samoa or in the Chateau region, or?
Well, we never deliberately took in names of places, and we certainly didn't take on people's names. The less we knew, the less we could be
less
bothered.
You could tell. But you managed to get across.
Oh yes, we waited until night time, and our aid.